This is KBOO's The Voice of the Middle East. صوت الشرق الأوسط من إذاعة كيبل و صدای خبرمیانه از رادیو KBOO.
طلوا حبابنا طلوا نسيبنا بين ربوعنا خلوا نحكي سهرات جوال وطلوا حبابنا طلوا بالفيات غنينا وعلى المياه لقينا على أقصى ما حلو من زاد الطير الشال نحن حكايات في بال منا نغمات موال نحن حكايات
صلى صلى
نحن حكايات في بال منا نغمات.
Welcome to another installment of Voices of the Middle East on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. This is Gudarz Ektidar, your host. For tonight's show, considering the changes that are happening kind of daily in the Middle East, and specifically the negotiation about the nuclear issue with Iran and the announcement this week of Secretary Rice that the United States will join the negotiation if Iran abandon the enrichment program. It's a pleasure to have Professor Eran Avrahamyan, who is a distinguished professor in the Department of History, Barak College, and the Graduate Center in the City University of New York. Dr. Avrahamyan has written a number of books on modern Iran, including Iran Between Two Revolutions, The Iranian Mujahideen, Khomeinism, Tortured Confessions, and most recently, Inventing the Axis of Evil, The Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria. Co-authored with Bruce Cummings and Moshe Moaz. Welcome to the show, Professor Avrahamyan.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, Doctor. Let me start with, maybe you can give a brief for the listeners on the history of U.S.-Iran relation before the Islamic Revolution and maybe the first two decades of the Islamic Revolution. How do you characterize this political relation between the U.S. and Iran?
Well, it's been back and forth. Obviously, before the revolution, the relations between the U.S. government and the Shah were very good, but the relations between the U.S. government and the Iranian people were not so good. And then after the revolution, things changed because, especially with the hostage crisis, the Iranian regime blamed the United States for the dictatorship that had existed under the Shah. And United States, of course, then blamed the Iranian government for the hostage crisis. So since really 1979-1980, relations have been very strained. There have been some periods, especially under the President Clinton, and President Khatami, there were relations somewhat improved, but were not normalized. And in more recent years, the main issue has been, of course, the nuclear issue. And at the moment, actually, the crisis obviously is on the U.S. fear that Iran is intending to develop a nuclear bomb, while Iran insists that its nuclear program is a civilian program, not a weapons program. And that's where the nitty-gritty comes down to now.
Could you also give us a little, maybe an introduction to what kind of, I mean, if there has been any signs from each side or conditions set forth for resumption of the relation between two countries, I mean, the official relations in the past. And you mentioned during the President Khatami and President Clinton, there were some kind of gestures, at least from Madeleine Albright, Secretary of State, and how these things played and how come it didn't work?
It was actually mostly bad timing. There was a period when Khatami, when he came in, he almost came very close to basically apologizing for the hostage crisis. But at that time, the leader in Iran, the supreme leader, was not that that keen on normalizing relations. So I think he put a brake on improvement of relations. Then there was a period when President Clinton almost came close to apologizing for the 1953 coup. But then there was pressure from Congress. And in fact, the sanctions from Congress were tightened up, and that actually hurt Iran-U.S. Trade. So that was scuttled. And since 2000, since President Bush came into office, the relations have fast deteriorated, mainly because the group of people in the administration that are usually called the neoconservatives were being very bellicose about Iran. They've made no secret that their desire is basically regime change, the overthrow of the Islamic Republic, and that obviously hasn't helped in improving relations.
You have made a comment recently that Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice's statement about America's willingness to talk to Iran has an important modification in U.S. position. Could you a little explain what kind of change do you see as far as U.S.'s gesture?
Yes, there are two major changes in U.S. policy in the last week. One is that it's U.S. is willing to actually negotiate with Iran. Until now, the U.S. has not been, under the Bush administration, has not been willing to negotiate. So that was seen as a major change. But hidden away in Rice's statement was, I think, an equally important change, that she said the United States was willing to accept Iran having a civilian nuclear program. And this was new, too, because in the last 4 years, the administration's been adamant that U.S. cannot tolerate Iran having any nuclear program, even if it's avowedly peaceful purposes, because it's too dangerous. It could develop into a weapons program. So there's two important changes, but I think we don't yet know what is in the actual proposal U.S. has sent to Iran. We'll know in the next week, but as the old saying goes, the devil's in the details. It could be that there will be serious proposals, in which case I think the problem could be resolved. But if in the fine print there are a lot of American conditions that are would be unacceptable for Iran, then obviously it will be a non-starter. The concern would be, for instance, if the United States said, well, Iran can have a civilian nuclear program, but not now, in future, or it could have it only on conditions that we are 100% sure it's only for civilian purposes. If a lot of conditions are put on Iran, I don't think the Iranian regime is going to go along with it. So in which case, the negotiations would quickly break down. But hopefully there won't be such stringent conditions put in that letter.
I'm sure you're aware that at some point in the past, Iranian negotiators have asked for some sort of guarantee, a security guarantee, and at least taken off the military option off the table when they were negotiating with Europeans. And apparently Europeans could not make that kind of commitment. But last week, probably 2 weeks ago, when Secretary Rice was interviewed on one of these network channels, she kind of took that position and the question that was put on the table whether she's willing to make a guarantee that there wouldn't be any military option against Iran. She said, "Well, if this is a kind of a peaceful program, why would that matter at all?" What is your opinion on that kind of statement?
Well, they're obviously intentionally trying to be somewhat ambiguous because they want to frighten Iran with the possibility that if Iran doesn't basically come forth, U.S. does have the option of using military force. But at the same time, they don't want to talk too much about military force because that would actually alienate the Europeans. The British have especially been saying that military force really is not in the thinking. There's also the practical problems that Iran knows that the United States at the moment is not in a position to really use military force because of the problems in Iraq. But obviously they don't want to remove it completely from the table because some people in Washington feel that military force should be always at least a threat to use against Iran. And this, of course, doesn't help the negotiations because if there is any talk of military force, it helps the diehards in Iran. And there, I think the equivalents to the neoconservatives there who really don't want a resolution to this because they feel Iran is in a good position to actually do whatever it wants without fear of United States. So it becomes a very complicated relations. It's not just between U.S. and Iran, but it's very between different tendencies in Washington and in Tehran, too.
Let me ask you, what is your analysis of what is going to happen next? I mean, what is your forecast?
Well, to be optimistic, I think the problem could be resolved because U.S. interest is Iran not getting the bomb. And Iran's interest is, it's always made it clear that they don't want the bomb. They want nuclear program, especially enrichment program for peaceful purposes. Now, since the U.S. has now moved to the position that it's willing to accept a civilian program, which could include an enrichment program, then there's no reason not to be optimistic, unless there are these sort of fine points in the proposal that would make it too much of an obstacle, such as the enrichment can take place, let's say, 10 years from now. But for 10 years, you know, Iran has to basically freeze its program. That I don't think will be acceptable to them. But on the other hand, Iran would have to give United States guarantees through inspections that the enrichment program they would have would not be on such a large scale, what's called industrial scale, to produce a bomb. And that should assure, obviously, United States that Iran is not interested in a bomb. But these are actually proposals that United Nations has suggested in the past of permitting Iran having an enrichment program, but an enrichment program that would be not on a scale enough to be able to make produce bombs. Hopefully that's the route the U.S. will go. But I think if there are very stringent rule sets, such as Iran couldn't in theory have enrichment, but not in practice, that just is not going to fly in Tehran, especially at this present mood and the feeling of confidence because of Iraq. I think the Iranian government will walk out of the negotiations And even if it alienates the Europeans, they would go ahead with the enrichment program, in which case there will be a major, I think, crisis between U.S. and Iran.
The Iranian party had suggested or proposed an international consortium to work on uranium enrichment on an industrial level or scale, as you refer to. Do you think any possibility for something like that to materialize?
Well, it depends where it was. The European proposal was actually, I think the Russians suggested first, would be that it would be done outside Iran, which I don't think would be in Iran's interest. I don't think they would accept that. Iran would be willing to have it in Iran, but it could be international, i.e. it could be Western companies jointly doing it with Iran. But again, if it's in Iran on a large scale, that would not be acceptable for United States. So what it boils down to is where is the enrichment taking place? If it's going to be in Iran, that would be okay for Iran, but it wouldn't be good for United States. If it's done outside Iran, that might be acceptable for the Europeans and Russia, but it wouldn't be acceptable for Iran. That's my understanding of it.
Okay. Setting aside the political issue of the nuclear program in Iran, do you see really an economic justification for all the, I guess, cost that is being spent on this, not only by paying third parties to purchase equipment, but also creating a chaos that at any time could have even cost hundreds of thousands of people's life in the country? What is the real, engine behind this commitment by Iranian government? They turned that issue into a national pride concept. They try to talk about it as a similar situation with the nationalization of oil back in 1950s. And Dr. Mossadegh attempt on that. And what is your opinion on this issue, and why is Islamic Republic is pushing it thus far?
Well, I think that they make an economic argument, and there is some justification for the economic argument in that Iran does need other alternate sources of energy besides petroleum and gas. It is actually investing quite a lot in hydroelectric as an alternative, but as even the fear existed in the 1970s that sooner or later the oil and gas are going to run out. So Iran does need other sources of energy. So there is some justification for nuclear as an alternative. And the expenses are not that actually huge. Building nowadays refineries is quite expensive, too. That's one reason very few countries have built oil refineries in the last 20 years. But I think beyond the economics, I think the real issue is, I think what you touched on, it's a question of national prestige, national honor, or the idea now being that to be on the cutting edge of modern science, to be basically an industrial society in the 21st century, you need to have nuclear technology, the scientists, the expertise. And it's a one way of sort of leapfrogging into the modern world. The old view would be the sort of the nuclear club. And I think Iran does have that aspirations. It's a sort of prestige aspirations that it being nuclear, but not being military nuclear, but scientifically nuclear, would basically give it what it deserves to be an important country in the world. Maybe not on par with Japan or Europe, but at least it's no longer a third world underdeveloped country. So that has become part of the national aspirations, I would say. And I think it also resonates in the public, and this is an area in which the regime does have actually public support.
I would like to move a little bit and change gear now that we have you in hand. And I know that you are one of the authorities basically on Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization. You wrote your book, 10, 15 years ago, I believe. And it's still one of the rare documentation on that organization. And the name of the organization came out several times recently as a potential group that could be used, especially being favored by some of the forces in Defense Department and also in the U.S. Congress. What state are these organizations at this time? Do you follow their path recently? Have you done that?
Well, only in what gets published. I haven't tried to go to Iraq to interview Mujahideen people at their camp or anything, but what information filters through here is that obviously the U.S. Surrounded the main base they had in Iraq. So they're probably about 5,000 to 6,000 Mujahideen there. And the administration was very much divided on what to do with the Mujahideen. There were some, you know, especially neoconservatives, who felt they could use them against Iran for infiltration, for spying, maybe even for sabotage. But there were others, such as the State Department, who had already actually categorized the Mujahideen as a terrorist organization, and obviously they couldn't do that, even legally. They couldn't do it by American law. So there was this, I would say, division within the Washington about how to deal with them. The way they resolved that is not to openly support the Mujahideen, but take volunteers from members of the Mujahideen who are willing to leave the Mujahideen and come out and then work for the Pentagon. Either in terms of giving information or, I suspect by now, infiltrating into Iran for gathering information or even for sabotage. So there are individuals, members of the Mujahideen, who are being used now as a part of destabilization of the regime. But I think the people who want to have regime change in Washington, if the negotiations don't succeed, they seem to be more now relying on ethnic organizations, not so much on the Mujahideen, but small organizations that have suddenly cropped up in the last year that claim to represent this or that minority group in Iran. So this actually is a historic change in American-Iranian relations. And ever since U.S. has had relations with Iran going back to early 20th century, U.S. has always been in support of the national integrity of the Iranian state. But in the last 2 years, there's been what the Washington says is using the ethnic card, i.e. Encouraging various ethnic groups to talk about federalism, about being oppressed, about basically challenging the Tehran government. And This is, in fact, very dangerous for Iran, but for the Middle East, too, because the logic of that is trying to turn Iran into what Iraq has become in the last 2 years since the invasion, a complete ethnic nightmare.
In the same line, I guess, in the past few weeks, there has been some unrest in Azerbaijan and the rest of the country by Azerbaijani people. And do you see any relation between these efforts in Washington and what is happening there? Or do you have any other suggestion for justification of these acts?
Well, I think it's not just Azerbaijan. There, in the last few months, there have been quite a lot of violence, kidnappings, bombings in Balochistan, in Khuzestan, in the Kurdish areas, and in the demonstrations in Azerbaijan. In all those areas, there are obviously some grievances, but as the old saying goes, it's no accident suddenly these grievances have taken shape in form of violence, and the fact that this has all come at a time when U.S. has, or some people in the U.S. government have been talking about using the ethnic card, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to say there's a connection between the two.
I assume that you also yourself belong to a religious minority in Iran.
Yes, I'm an Armenian, yes.
What is your personal experience as far as discrimination against the minorities and ethnic groups in Iran?
I wouldn't call it discrimination. The various, each ethnic group has had a different history, and the religious minorities that are legally recognized, which would be the Christians, Armenians, Assyrians, also the Zoroastrians and the Jewish, have a legal status in which they have representation in parliament. They have their own councils. They actually have their own religious laws they can practice. So there is no, I would say, no religious persecution in that way. Obviously, in terms of jobs, especially state jobs, people from the minorities are at a disadvantage in trying to get through this into high positions in state ministries or departments. So there's a, so we could say, unofficial bias there, but in terms of a status, it's not persecution. The problem, then the issues of the linguistic minorities is different. Linguistic minorities such as Kurds, Baluchis, Arabs, Azerbaijanis. There again, the state is much more in favor of Persian because Persian is the state language, the educational language. But on the whole, actually, those linguistic minorities are far better treated now than they were under the Pahlavi monarchy. In fact, the languages can be used for publications, for local use. And I wouldn't say there is a strong tension between the linguistic minorities and the Iranian state. In the Kurdish areas, it's somewhat complicated now by the fact that there is a de facto Kurdish independence in North Iraq, and this could overflow for aspirations of Kurds in Iran to have also independence. But I don't think that's a major problem because the Kurds in Iraq can, in fact, use their pressure on Kurds in Iran not to be too vociferous, because the Kurds in Iraq very much depend on Iran for basically survival, because there's always the fear that Turkey might invade. And if that happens, the Kurds in Iraq would very much depend on Iran as their protectors. And basically, in the past also, they've really kept good relations with Iran. So the president of Iraq, for instance, Talabani, he spends going back and forth to Tehran because he wants to keep as good relations as he can with Iran. You could at first sight say, you know, Iran really has a serious problem with the Kurds. But I think in practical terms, that problem can be controlled because of the situation in Iraq. There's another minority that I think has the most serious problems, which is the Baha'i minority, because they're a religious minority, but they're not accepted as a legitimate minority. So the persecution that has occurred since the revolution has been really directed at the Baha'is. And that's a situation, of course, it was worst in the 1980s. Under the Khatami administration, it improved. And time will show whether things will continue to improve or maybe even get worse as far as the Baha'is are concerned. There it's really a theological problem, because for the Shi clerics, Baha'ism is a form of apostasy, and they have trouble with dealing with that.
One last question. Your book, Torture Confessions, touched on many aspects of human rights violations in Iran, and specifically you dedicated a whole chapter to the I would call the massacre that happened in 1986 and 87 in prisons. Do you think that in any way or shape these negotiations could be somehow linked with a human rights situation in Iran, as being also suggested by Dr. Shirin Ebadi, the Nobel laureate?
I don't think it's useful to bring issues of human rights when states are dealing really with state issues. Here, the state issues being the nuclear issue, or the U.S. interest or not interest in regime change. I think once you bring in issue of human rights, however important it is an issue, it really muddies the problem. And there are a lot of countries, of course, violate human rights. And I'm not sure United States, especially now, is in a position to lecture other countries on a violation of human rights and even the question of democracy. I think it just makes us in the United States look hypocritical if we start talking about other countries have to abide by the Geneva Convention, since people in the White House consider Geneva Convention somewhat of a quaint old document. That's the phrase they use, the quaint document. So if United States considers human rights and a quaint document, then someone like the president of Iran can basically say, well, we also consider it a quaint document. We don't have to at least answer to United States whether we are abiding with it or not. I think human rights is much better left to people who focus on that, such as Amnesty or Human Rights Watch or NGOs. But once governments get involved in it, it just really makes politics much more complicated. Well, it makes the politics much more heated, and you're not going to get resolutions on important issues such as the nuclear issue.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Abrahamian. It was a great pleasure, and I hope we can get you on the show in the future as well.
Thank you for inviting me.